memory as months alone. To live in a world changed by my wife, but that did not contain her. In those days, I began to miss her differently than I had missed her in the years we shared these rooms with the foundling. And also, I came to resent the attitudes of the fingerling, who swim sharp circles around my heart and lungs, rejoicing at my wife's abandonment, her escape, that easy proof of what unsteady structure our family had been.
So that's a man called the husband, and he's the narrator for Matt Bell's beguiling new novel, In the House, Upon the Dirt, Between the Lake and the Woods. A title so endearingly serpentine in length that you won't necessarily get it right even if you commit it to memory, as you will soon hear in the following show. But the guy who wrote it is Matt Bell, and if you can't remember the title, I'm sure you can work it out from his name. So this novel is ambiguous enough for you to fill in the details, yet specific enough in its language to suggest something else. You have this guy. He's the husband. He lives with his wife in a house that has many rooms. The wife can actually sing material into being. The husband is plagued by this fingerling thing shuffling within his insides, which could be something corporeal and Cronenbergian, or it could be part of his imagination. There are mysterious squids, wild beasts, all sorts of creatures who the husband is contending with. And yet, you remain fascinated by this world because Matt Bell strikes this uncanny balance between keeping his cards close to his chest and imparting a few pivotal clues that keep you reading the book. I met with Matt Bell in Bay Ridge a few weeks ago, on Bloomsday no less, and despite the ridiculously early morning hour, we talked about everything from Gary Lutz-style sentence rumination to William Blake's distinction between allegory and vision to video games and mansplaining. Well, you'll have to listen for yourself. But if you're joining us for the first time, hello there, welcome. My name is Edward Champion, and this is The Bat Segundo Show. You can check out more than 500 conversations with authors, filmmakers, and other uncanny figures at www.batsegundo.com. Please also visit us on iTunes, and if you like the show, feel free to rate and review it. Please also pass along word of the program to your pals, as word of mouth helps to keep the show going and alive. Anyway, without further ado, here is Matt Bell. Okay, so I am here with Matt Bell, who is most recently the author of, I'm going to get this right, In the House, Upon the Dirt, Between the Creeks, Between the Lakes, Between the Lake and the Trees. And the woods. No, I totally mangled it. You know what? I said this like six times this morning. So, In the House, Upon the Dirt, Between the Lake and the Woods.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd committed this to memory. And memory. It is a very early morning.
It's Sunday morning.
Yeah,
right.
Sunday morning. We squeezed this in at the last minute. It's totally cool. Anyway, Matt, it's a pleasure to chat with you. What a hell of a title.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it's a lot. You know, when I was first like sending the book to my agent and out to publishers and stuff, like every time I wrote the title, I'd write the whole thing out.
Yeah.
Because I was like always worried someone would make me like name it like a one word thing. Right. And so I just tried to like block it by being like, this is really important to me. Look how often I type it.
Well, how should we refer to this? Should we refer to it as house?
In the house is good, I think.
In the house.
That's fine. Yeah.
In the house. In the house makes it sound like some sort of like house party.
Right. Right.
Kid and play.
Exactly, right.
I've neglected to ask, how are you doing, sir?
I'm good. Yeah. Thank you.
So when I finished this book, I was especially intrigued by how you kept the world of this book open enough for the reader to fill in the blanks, while also the husband's emotions are also fairly open. But also, it's fairly closed in the way that he's cut off from the world and the rest of society, and he's confined to this life that is pretty much his wife, the fingerling, and the foundling. I had found, actually, instead of actually referencing that, which I will reference later, I'm actually going to reference a quote you tumbled.
Okay.
Great. Only 90 minutes ago.
Oh, go.
Yeah, yeah. That's how current we are here. Ironically, that's will air many weeks later. But anyway.
Right.
So you had quoted Kate Bernheimer.
Yes, absolutely.
From sentence to sentence in fairy tales, there is no reality that is subordinated to any other. Just as outside the pages, there is no reality. So, you know, I'm wondering, do you feel that the best fairy tales or the best stories involve, you know, this finding the right balance along the lines of this open and closed and all that? How did you arrive at the balance for this book?
Yeah, well, I think there's one of the ways I think about it, I guess, is that there's like there's lots of kinds of writers, but there's two kinds of writers for this model, right? And there's people who are like includers, people who are like excluders, right? You're writing, sometimes you're writing the great American novel and it's like you're jamming everything from like your decade into like the book, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to get it all in here. I'm going to capture the entire American experience. And I think there's, and that's one way to make a book. It's like to try to capture the world and put it in a book. And I think the other is to try to like make a world and to push back, like to write from the center out and like define your sort of boundaries, so that what you're creating becomes the world of the book and it doesn't have these outside things. And I think at the end there was like a balance act to that in the book. Like, you know, as you know, there are these allusions sort of to the outside world. Yes. And where they're from. And I wanted it to be there. I didn't want this to be completely abstract or like separate. But for the most part, the only things that can happen are things that are already in this world within the first like 30 pages, right? Like the world is built fairly quickly and then it has to be, the only way they can solve their problems or progress the story is using these elements and using these things. And I found that really interesting. That's one of the reasons I think for the long, title is like that setting is part of the book's constraint in sure. a certain way. And knowing that was really helpful.
Well, it offers a maximal precision right. with minimal revelation.
Right. Yeah. That's a really nice way to say it. And so I really enjoy that kind of writing where the world of the book sort of is self-built and self-contained. Which isn't to say that I don't like the other kind either, but I think that those modes are really different. And Bernheimer speaks to that for me. Rune Fetterman talks about that in Crit of Fiction, talks about a similar thing. Like the book is the world, rather, you know, I'm paraphrasing badly and from years ago, but like the book itself is a world, and really no matter what you're writing about.
Yeah.
If you're writing in a very realist mode, that's still the case. Like the language the book is all you have to work with. And the outside world doesn't necessarily enter in the same way. So.
But I'm wondering, as a writer,
sure.
do you feel what I felt as a reader? Because I kept saying, well, okay, there's a lot of fishing and hunting going on, but like, how do they actually develop the skills to make things? Aside right. from, of course, the magic that you have in right. the book. I'm thinking like, okay, I'm thinking pragmatics.
Absolutely.
Even though I'm also involved with the imagination, and I'm involved right. with the world that you're creating, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, how did they get here? Why this particular location?
Right.
How did the Fingerling get into this? And we right. don't actually have the answers to those questions. And right. so I'm wondering how much they aggravate you as an author, or do you know the questions, the answers to these right. questions, and you just don't want to impart certain things to the reader?
No, I think a lot of it works. It's a fairy tale or mythic sort of yeah. mode, right? So like... they can do it because they have to for the story, right? Which you can't get away with in a different mode. There were some things that were funnier that I was like wrong about, and I was too specific about them. And early readers, the lake, of course, is salty, which causes them like a drinking water problem. And in the early versions of the book, they were always like boiling water for like drinking water.
Huh.
But when you boil salt water, you don't end up with clean water.
Yeah,
you end up with salt, right?
Yeah.
So you know when I was trying to explain the pragmatics, it was actually getting in the way a lot, or it was causing problems. He's a fisherman who becomes a trapper because that's what's necessary for his family. That's what, you know, that's the next thing. And some of that works with the wife singing stuff into being, right? It's like the next object that is necessary is this, and so here it is.
Yeah.
Which in fairy tales would just happen in a sentence. It would just appear, and there's sort of this device that does some of that. But I agree, like he becomes a taxidermist at one point just because... Yes. Because that's what he needs to do, you know? The wife is able to... She doesn't study maze making before she sings the maze yeah. under the house, you know? And you can get away with that, I hope, in this mode. Where in other kinds of books, of course, that would be... Yeah, we'd have to watch the guy study it for 15 years or something, yeah.
This leads me to ask, to what degree fabulism served as a method for you to, I guess, deal with the hurdles of, oh, we can't actually boil salt water. Let's just go ahead and have her sing something into existence.
Right.
You know, when did that come as a sort of... I don't want to say crutch, but was that a method for you right. to kind of maximize the world here? I mean, how did that happen?
I mean, I think it pre-existed it. Yeah. So, you know, so... it ends up helping with some of that stuff,
sure.
but that's not, you know, the reasoning for it. The very first image I had for the book, the first thing I wrote isn't actually in the book, but it was this husband watching his wife singing and seeing all these, like having this vision of all these like shapes she had within her that she could one day bring into the world, right? And being intoxicated and entranced by this. And that was why he had married her. He had seen this world she was going to sort of sing into being. And of course, the book ended up going, and it doesn't work exactly like that. But so that singing was like the foundational aspect of this world in a certain way. I don't know. I think that's... I never thought about this when I was writing it. But looking back, I think it's interesting that I had to discover this whole world through his voice and his very limited egomaniacal sort of point of view. When she's sort of like the creating aspect of the world in a weird way, right? So the person I had to create it through is not the person who's like the creator of most of the world they spend their time in.
Yeah. Are you a singer at all? I'm curious.
No, terrible. Yeah, oh, okay. It's awful. No,
you don't do karaoke or anything?
I know. You know, weirdly, we had a Soho Press karaoke thing. So I did. No, I grew up, you know, Midwest Catholic. Like, I just mumbled through songs a lot. And yeah, music. I love music. Music's really a big and part of my life. But no, not a singer in any way. Huh. Thankfully, yes. No samples for you today.
Why do you think music served as the act of creation for the wife in this, to create rooms, to create objects and all that? I'm wondering why you associate that with music. Was it largely because, I mean, I know you're big on sentences, and I'll get into that in a little bit, and you're big on language. It's interesting that you have like language kind of tangoing with music here, and I'm wondering, you know, how that came into being or possibly why, at the risk of delving into, you know, ambiguity in terms of
sure. No, absolutely. And the first answer always sounds so weak because it's like partly I don't know, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's what was right, it was what instinctually happened. I think it's interesting. I think like we, you know, music has those deep links to emotion. It's weird to describe someone singing a lot in a book because you never get to hear it, right? But there's something very abstract about that's really nice. Or a part, the husband talks and talks and talks. The husband is this, you can just imagine them together. Like he'd be that husband that never stops talking. The wife never speaks, right?
Yeah.
But then when she does open her mouth, she's able to do this like thing, you know? And in the early parts of the book, there's only a few times where she has the upper hand in a conversation, and she's often like explaining to him like the way the world could be. And he's missing it totally, right? He's missing this world they could have. And it's something that she can give him by doing this. There's so much of like he comes to this place and he's in this possessor way, right? He's like, he's building the house. I'm going to get the food. I'm going to build the house. I'm going to do all these things. And she's completely, she's self-sufficient because she can do this in a way that he's not. That's nice. It's that he can't sing, he can't do this, but his mouth is always open, he's always talking. He can do all these things by taking from the world, but she can make them herself. And those differences were important to me, the way that those things balanced or sort of offset each other.
Is it difficult to describe the magic of singing in fiction? I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, largely because it's Bloomsday as we're talking, is, of course, the wonderful description of singing in the dead.
Right.
You know, you absolutely feel the power of that. I mean, you know, but in this, the singing brings things into creation.
Right.
You know, is that easier for you to wrap your head around as a writer? Or, I mean, how do you get into that act of creation? I mean, being a creative person who describes the act of creation, it gets pretty difficult.
Absolutely.
How do you work around that?
I feel like there's less actual description of it now than there was in early versions. Like, I think I tried more directly to sort of like describe what the singing was like or something, but that's almost impossible, right? But I think there's some, I mean, I feel like everybody's probably hearing it differently as they're reading, but by leaving it a little blanker, there's a little more room for the reader to fill that in. I think at one point it was very specific and it was like in the way, right? And now there's sort of that, again, that sort of fairy tale mode where you can say she was singing and it was doing this, and there's an image that goes along with that and a sound that goes along with it. And everybody's is a little different, and that's totally fine because it doesn't need to be in the, you know, I don't even know what the terms are, in the key of C or whatever it is, you know, who cares, right? Like, that's just not important. The important is more the outcome and sort of the feeling of it. And so sometimes by flattening that a little bit, I think you actually get more out of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up William Blake and his vision of the Last Judgment.
Okay.
You know, he was careful to distinguish between fable and vision. Fable, of course, sort of being this cheap allegory that was an inferior kind of poetry, what he described as formed by the daughters of memory.
Nice.
Now, vision, which is what he preferred, or imagination, this was represented what actually exists. So there are portions of your novel, especially with the material involving the squid, which was reshaping into the husband's body, that sort of seem to have these two Blake distinctions in mind. The words fable and vision, however, don't actually appear in the book. I looked for them because I got obsessed with this. When you were writing this book, to what extent were you wrestling with distinctions along these lines? I'm curious. Or, you know, were you writing in any kind of broader mythological distinction?
Right.
I mean, I know you reference a number of fairy tales.
Sure, yeah. I think, I mean, myth was sort of the term I thought of a lot when I think of it that way. But I've changed the way I think about sort of, called my work non-realist for a long time because that was sort of a term I felt comfortable with when asked. And I'm sort of feel like I'm moving away from it a little bit, in part because of other people's helpful thinking on the subject. Brian Evanson, whose work is a big influence on mine, thankfully, I saw him give a talk a couple years ago, and he was talking about growing up Mormon and growing up in a culture that religion and like day-to-day life aren't separate, right? Like he literally grew up in a religion where like angels come to earth and like interact with people, and like and I grew up Catholic but in a very literal sort of family, and you know, people interact with angels, and they talked about like the burning bush. That's not a myth, that's not a symbol, that's like a thing that like happened in the past. And I'm not religious anymore, and I've sort of moved away from that direction, but I think that writing something like this and letting these sort of magical or fabulous elements ride alongside like a really grounded sort of feels, it's less non-realist and more like where I'm from, right? Like there's a way in which that's my backstory as much as like the geography I'm from in that. So it's weird. Like I feel like I want more and more for them to be able to coexist, that these people live in a world in which the fantastical is real. And so did I once, you know?
Yeah. So the fantastic is a kind of religiosity for you that has replaced your previous religiosity.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, or like it's another way to access some of those feelings or to get to some of those places. And it's a way to write about sort of where my magic comes from and where some of these things are seated in me that that I have trouble getting to sometimes in a more strictly realist story.
So realism is difficult for you, you'd say, to write?
Yeah, it's different for me to write. And I think, but I think the links through that even are sort of, I mean, even the most realist writer is incorporating all those like liminal moments or like those sort of magical way, you know, Dennis Johnson was one of the first writers I really loved in, you know, my early 20s. And the way that his stuff slides into that sort of liminal space was very attractive to me and felt very, very true sort of to experience. But I would never think of him as like Jesus' son. I wouldn't think of as having fabulous elements, really, even though it has some of those places where the angels descend in the, you know, the cemetery and all this stuff, and people are living in sort of a, you know, they shift over for a minute, you know? So I like those modes. I like that way. Here it's really surfacey, right? It's obviously all the way at the top. People are fighting giant bears and stuff. But even when I'm writing something more realist, I think it has to be acknowledged that way that life skews weird or we fall out of like the experience other people are having for a second, you know? So I want that to be part of the work.
So, I mean, yes. Whether you're writing in a realist mode or a fabulist mode, you need to have that liminal space. Would you say that the best fiction has to occupy this wide swath of liminal space that is presented on the page as a very sort of limited
space? Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to make maybe value judgments for like broad things, but I think that the writing I like the most often does, or allows for it at least. Makes some, you know, I Cormac McCarthy's a writer, of course. I mean, I love, everybody loves.
I know you're always a big Road fanboy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was writing about the Road yesterday, you know. but the way that a moment can go from like the grittiest sort of realism to that sort of move to the mythic that he makes, you know, and I love that. That works really well for me. That you know, gets into my emotional space really well. And there feels sometimes, if I don't want to say, I was going to say the word dishonest. I don't want to say the word dishonest, but it feels slightly unlikely to write like a worldview that allows for absolutely none of that. Like, even the most like reason-driven people I know don't live in this like completely reasoned, realist,
science-based,
fact-based. Because what does that even mean, right? I mean, we could get into that for hours, but like, so I want there to be some acknowledgement of that, or that way that, you know, we don't actually interact with the world that way.
Could you identify, at the risk of bad-mouthing another writer, could you identify a writer that actually does a harmful version of that sort of fact-based rigidity that is really kind of getting in the way of that liminal space, which just seems to be the ideal that you pursue as a writer?
Yeah, you know what, I'm not sure. I don't always like read it as like, I'm rarely reading a novel and being like, oh, this guy's not making room for everyday magic or something, right? I just don't feel that. So I'm not sure I can even think of something that I've read recently off the top of my head. Maybe we'll come around to it. If it comes up, I'll point it at it. You'll say somebody's name and be like, that guy. You know?
that guy with the baseball bat.
Let's go back.
Let's go get him.
Believe in magic, you know, it'll be good. Yeah.
I mean, no, but going back to what you were saying about how even the most fact-based people you know still have to associate, still have to imagine.
Right.
I mean, what you're talking about is how imagination leads the writer and the reader into this liminal space.
Right.
I mean, you know, is that liminal space more of a vicarious territory, or is it something that you're inclined to set up, or the author is responsible for setting up?
Yeah, so I think you have to make space for it, or you have to allow for it. I think that there's a one of the things that I rarely know what I'm doing when I'm writing a first draft of a book, right? I'm not a planner. I have no clue, usually. I'm just sort of following around. I'm packing mysteries that have been set up by earlier. You know, you just write a statement. It's like, well, I'll go find out what that means now. And so, like, for me, there's this... I go through this, like, process of, like, mystery when I'm writing the book. And I do my planning in later drafts. I write outlines for second drafts and rewrite toward the outline. And often in that process, I nail everything down too much, right? Like, I have to figure it out, right?
Yeah.
And then there's like this process of like putting the magic back into the world, like taking some of that stuff out and carving out the explanations, making room for the reader. I never think of the book as like having like the job is not, I don't have a message I'm trying to give to you. I don't have the narrator, perhaps obviously in this book, is not like an avatar for an ideal kind of person to be who I want you to see. Writing the book was an experience for me, and I think at the end of it, you have to make that space for it to be an experience for the reader. And so sometimes you can make those spaces for magic or liminal experiences by removing some of the logic, by removing some of the explanation. Our brain will naturally want to make these sort of logical connections, and when they're not clear or when something weird has happened, we skew magical first, I think, in the same way that, I mean, that seems even very cultural, right? Like in the absence of like scientific explanation, we'll provide some other kind of story explanation, which is great and a good thing to be able to use. I'd never think of this consciously as I'm writing, of course. But those modes are nice and they're interesting and they're, I think we all have them and they can be given access to them in a story in a way that's hard.
I think what you're talking about is how imagination springs from precision. I mean,
that's a better way to say it. Thanks for, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this morning, so I was reading this story about how it's Bloom's Day today.
Right, talking.
And there was some place that was basically, we're going to set a new record for the number of Joyce lookalikes who we can get to show up. And this just, I was stuck on this. And I was imagining opening the door and everybody just... By edict, having to look like James Joyce. And I kept thinking to myself, well, what happens if, like, you know, I was thinking James Joyce's They Live, put on the glasses and everybody is James Joyce. I started thinking about, like, well, that's why would so many people, so many lookalikes want to get into a particular one place, whether for Bloom's Day or anything else? And my imagination, I couldn't stop it. It was like turning on, I had to actually, you know, control myself and had to have a long, lengthy conversation with my girlfriend before I could get off this topic.
It's a great conflict because, like, the whole point of being a lookalike is to like be mistaken for that person.
Yes.
So if you purposely go to a place where there's a lot of them,
exactly.
No, this is
but
good,
but
right.
it's the specific of record and Joyce lookalikes that creates this
absolutely
this own liminal space.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe that's what we're talking about in fiction.
You know, I think it's in Portland. They have or used to have. I'm trying to remember. I read another book like these like I think sort of like anarchy driven like Santa Claus like parades over everyone are dressed up as Santa Claus.
They have them here in New York.
Okay,
too.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, and I don't know.
They have the New York's the Santa subway rides. And things like that.
Right. And you know that coming across something like that, not knowing what it is.
Yeah.
Right. Immediately puts you in this like reality's broken down in this certain way. You know. And you know it's not magical, but for a minute it's like, what is happening here? And those feelings are everyday and normal, and I think worth tapping into. Yeah.
This leads me to ask, because I know you have a very, based off of your Facebook
updates
at least, you have a very specifically organized, regimented day.
Yeah.
And you know... My feeling is that, you know, writers do need to get out of the house.
Right.
They need to engage with people. Yeah. But I have this conversation with writers where they're saying, oh, it's the choice between writing fiction or hanging out with a friend.
Right.
So, you know, what do you do to have those moments that trigger greater imagination? How do you regiment your life so that, you know, you're not having to prefer fiction over friends? Or do you have to make that
No, I mean... So I write as soon as I get up in the morning, and I write from like time I get up until like noon or one every day. And then I teach and edit and do my other stuff in the afternoons and the evenings. And just by putting it first, it allows me to do whatever I want with the rest of my life. I don't know if I'll, maybe I will be. I find it hard to believe that I will write 365 days a year, like 12 hours a day or something. I can't work that way either. At some point you get sloppy because you're writing too much. You have to, you know, there's a right amount.
Did you write this morning?
I did, yeah. Oh, wow. Very early for a little bit. But yeah.
So even if you get like an hour or two here on a busy day, you can...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I feel like in traveling and doing book tour kind of stuff, like the responsibility is like to like touch the new project every day, to like make sure it's in my head, make sure I'm looking at it. I went to bed at 2 a.m. last night and I was looking at it on my iPad, just like keeping something in my head, right? To keep the concerns there so there something's happening. And so that leaves the rest of the day for the rest of life, you know. I love teaching. Teaching's really great. I love being in the classroom and sort of engaging that way. I've, you know, a good group of friends to spend time with. You know, we get out and, you know, we're out hiking and stuff and you're doing other things. A lot of my life happens in books, in art and in music and stuff. You know, I think you have two things you can draw on to make a book, right? Your life experience and your art experience, right? These are the two things you have. And some writers are like 95% life experience. And, you know, like everything's coming directly from that. And other people are the opposite. I did a reading with Norman Locke the other night, and he was talking about his company, like everything begins with another text. Like there's always like his engagement with art is why he's making art, you know?
Yeah.
And that's maybe like the other extreme. And neither one being better than the other. But so it's weird. So somewhere I go to recharge isn't necessarily like my life is good and sort of ordinary. And that's not where I'm going to recharge for fiction. I'm going to recharge for fiction maybe in other books or in movies or something like that. So it's interesting to see that balance. There's always real life stuff coming in. I think you can see in that book things that were happening to me in my real life that, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there. But you can also see my reading life over the years I was writing the books. You know, the way that is a lot of my experience that I'm going through on a day-to-day basis.
Do you think that there is too much conversation about, oh, well, what incident came plucked from my real life? Right. I mean, that actually it really is books more than real life that gets books written.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely always an interest in biography of the writer in a way that... that's maybe unfair sometimes or gets in the way of other concerns. It's easier to talk about sometimes than talk about books. I know that comes up with this book in particular because of the family's series of miscarriages that sort of set off a lot of the plot. There's been a couple of times in interviews like an assumption that's based on something that's happened with my wife and I, and it's not. And that sometimes you just have to parse that out. You know, that's something that people are curious about. And I don't begrudge them that curiosity necessarily, but I would rather talk about the book than talk about my biography. It's awesome. Nothing else. The book is far more interesting,
I wanted to talk about the foundling and the fingerling. I mean, these are words that are so close to thing.
Right. That's interesting.
And when I think of fingerling, of course, I was thinking of potato. I was thinking of the books that were authored by Dick Lawn.
I don't know.
Oh, there's this set of children's books by this guy named Dick Lawn. They're, I believe, Dutch.
Okay.
And it's about this little guy who's a fingerling who lives amidst...
I'm going to have to check those out.
Exactly. But this leads me to wonder, I mean, where did fingerling originate from? Is it a case sometimes where you find a word and that actually predates the concept? Or is it the other way around?
No, that's absolutely what happened, the predating. I was... I absolutely wrote about the fingerling finally the first day I worked on it. Had no idea what they were. And it was like this, it was writing about the husband and the wife, the husband speaking, and he's, I just wrote these sentences, like, and I don't remember exactly how they went anymore, but it was like, you know, like, for you, the foundling, and for me, the fingerling, and like, and it was like, they're making this division between them, like, each of them had their chosen child, and I was like, well, what are these people, what are the terms of them, you know, and there was a lot of stuff like that. I had a good first day, or like 1,000 words the first day I worked in the book, and I'd put the bear in play and the singing the second moon and the fingerling and the foundling and I had no idea what any of these things meant or how they connected.
The bear was pretty early on, out of curiosity.
Yeah, but just like the seeing the bear, right? Like this first like seeing the bear in the field the first time and you know, I didn't really know how the bear worked or what the bear was doing, but I could keep writing scenes where the husband was in conflict or was with it in confrontation, and eventually like the terms of that started to appear. And there was a lot of that, like these individual sentences which contain a mystery, which I could unpack or discover or just keep putting these characters in conflict with each other. And I end up, you know, all these fragments and you start seeing the way they connect. And so it's weird. So, like, yeah, they came very organically. I didn't know the fingerling. I wrote about the fingerling being in the husband's body before I knew how it got there. You know, like, so I had, you know, some of these things were sort of discovered later. Yeah, they're very evocative words. They have just a lot of I mean, what's the thing? And I had forgotten about fingerling potatoes, like, completely. And I didn't talk to him about the book for, like, 2 years while I was working on it. And then at some point I told him, and they're like, oh, like, potatoes. I was like, shit.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, like, but I guess. But it's not a bad image, though, right? It
kind of
works.
Americans, yeah. Couch potatoes, right? If you're taught anything from that, you know. Maybe the fingerling is the sort of our obesity problem. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, is this, yes. Yeah, brilliant accidental social the commentary. Allegory, yes, yeah, right, yes, right, yes, right. Yeah.
That's your George Romero allegory that turns into great art.
Right, yes. Good. Yes, that's inflated.
That's exactly what I meant. well, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, mystery and how language creates mystery. Because if you are getting closer to publication and putting a book together, at some point, the mystery is going to close off or siphon off or taper off. Right. And so, you know, what do you do? It seems to me you're a guy who is fueled by mystery. And that's what keeps the book going. And that's what keeps you going every single day, especially when you're looking at the text and you see more mystery.
Right. I was, I got really concerned about it at some point that the husband was running down the mystery in the world and would, like, at some point, like, be in possession of all the answers.
Yeah.
Which doesn't quite happen, but as you know, like, there's a coda at the end of the book. Yeah. And part of the function of that to me was to, like, reopen the book in a certain way, right?
Yes.
That the husband had sort of solved the mystery to his satisfaction. But I hate reaching the end of the book and have it, like, now it's a closed system or closes off. And it wasn't really that anyway, but I wanted something that, like, opened the doors back up again or, like, let, you know. And it's sort of in contradiction we talked about the Bernheimer and Fetterman, like, the idea of the world of the book is this closed sort of thing. And it might be open in an interpretation way, but it's, like, all self-contained. And I wanted the story to be reopened somewhere and to sort of allow for more story than, like, the husband had found in the world. You know, like, there's other story here. And that became really important to me, that that coda functioned in that way, that it somehow would increase the mystery again at the very end. Because I hated the idea that all these things that had been so generative for me and I'd spent so many years, like, discovering would now be given to the reader in, like, a look at what I found and there's nothing for you to do here way, you know, which seems unfair, you know.
On the other hand, I mean, it seems to me that you're almost resisting any kind of narrative device that serves as an instrument. That if you are, if a character suddenly becomes a tool to advance a story, then it seems to me that you're, oh God, now I'm just like any other kind of traditional type of book. I mean, you know, but on the other hand, you have to have at least a little bit of that because you're not going to reach a reader sometimes unless you have that narrative structure. So, you know, what do you do to, you know, deal with this possible hang up or preference, shall we say?
Right. No, I mean, different characters serve different functions in the story, you know, and I think there were versions where it was bad in that way. I didn't know a character well enough. So, like, because the wife is, especially in early versions, was much more of a cipher for me. I didn't know much about her. And he didn't, and part of his problem is he doesn't know much about his wife, you know.
Talk about mansplaining.
Right. Oh, my God. Yes, the whole book, right? Yeah. He's just like, and you know, she has such a better grasp on the world they live in than he does until, of course, he, you know, she doesn't. But yes, he's the worst. But so I.
Drawn from personal experience.
Right. Hopefully not. But you could ask my wife, maybe. But no, I think that it's important that the foundling be his own character and that there'd be some kind of emotional link with that character. It's important that the wife at least be able to sense that she's her own character and that she has this life that's independent of him and it's not, that they're not tools for the progression story. And it's tricky because there probably are versions in everything I've written in drafts where, like, other characters aren't as strong, especially in first person where the speaker just dominates so strongly the story. And maybe especially in, like, an egomaniacal mode like this where he's just, you know. But yeah, I don't want them to just be plot devices. And I want the reader to do some of the work of filling them and sort of making them the right character for them. But there's a limit to that. I think that, yeah, you do have to give the reader something. There was definitely a version of this that was twice as long.
I was curious about this.
Yeah, so we can talk about that a little bit. But, like, that version was like, look at what a big, complex, like, impressive novel.
I'm a writer.
Right, no,
this is my novel.
It's maybe that's a first novel problem, and maybe that's just limited to my own egomanias. But, like, there was definitely a version that was like, Look at what I can make.
You wanted to write the great American novel.
Yeah, and I don't know. The great American fabulous.
Right.
But I was but this is a version that's much more reader focused and much more about the experience they're having than the one that I'm trying to prove that I had. Yeah. Right. Oh, thank God, right? You know, and I think I learned a lot about, like, I mean, his first novel, I learned a lot about how to find the trajectory inside, you know, sort of the mess of, like, the grandness that it could, you know, the project was at one point. But it's weird, like, cutting back, I mean, there was no, I didn't cut any events out of it.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I cut a lot of that connective tissue, or, like, my logic, so that the story logic could be partly the reader's as well. They don't need to read my version of it, you know, in some ways. So,
what kind of bloat was in this massive draft that you had to get rid of? What was the sort of I am a writer moments? I'm curious.
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of just saying everything over and over, a lot of exposition, a lot of, you know, more of the husband, like, pontificating everything. You were seeing his entire thought process was sort of in the book, in a way that it didn't need to be. And maybe it needed to be to write it. You know, I think that I have several other writers I've seen talk about, like, you know, you have a 300-page final book, but you can still, like, you can sense that it was once a 600-page book rather than a book that was always a 300-page book. That enlarged world still sort of somehow is sensible. And maybe that's just what all of us overwriters say to make ourselves feel better about having to do it. But yes, it was good. So a lot of exposition came out, a lot of connective tissue, a lot of thinking through the logic of the world in the voice of the book, right? Like, I'm writing day to day, trying to figure it out, and I'm writing in his voice, but it's really me, like, piecing it together, you know? It's like, oh, that's what's happening with the, you know, the maze or something. And so a lot of that came out, a lot of scaffolding. It's scaffolding, right? A lot of the scaffolding came out of the book. And no matter how pretty you make the scaffolding, no one wants to look at that, you know, right? You want to see the building. So, yeah. So it's all good. I mean, I'm not sitting around regretting anything that came out of the book. I'm very, very happy that it's all jettisoned and hidden.
Well, to get back to this issue of looking at a book, I know that in an interview you did with Andrew Irvin at Tin House, you said that you had this 40-page finite point where you can hold 40 pages in your head at one time and that's it. Now, if you're dealing with either a 600-page draft or a 300-page draft, how do you hold all of that in your head? I mean, is it just you have to work on it and compartmentalize? How does this work for a novel? I'm curious.
So, it's a trick, right? Because I'd really found that was, like, sort of the limit. Partly at the end of drafts, I started working a lot more hours a day. At the very end of, like, every draft, I was working like 10 hours a day instead of 4 or 5, which meant that you were getting through the book faster and you could sort of see more of it. So that was part of it. In later drafts, I outlined from the first to second draft, had this like 10,000 word narrative outline, like in the voice of the book, sort of. And so I could use that sort of as a, to keep me on track, right? I wrote the outline of the first draft, then revised it into a plan for the second draft and retyped completely and rewrote. And I could use that when I was lost. I could read the outline again. I would just sit down, it's 10,000 words. I'd sit down, I'd read through it. And for a little bit long, you know. And eventually, you just get better at knowing the landscape of the book. You know where you're at. It's like you've moved to a city and you've lived there a couple years, and you know that when you're in this neighborhood, you're near this neighborhood. Yeah. You know,
it helps that in this case there aren't a lot of people around.
Right, there aren't a lot of people.
You know,
right?
This leads me to ask, like, if you're dealing with a super populated world, that's got to be hugely difficult.
I imagine. I have no idea.
Well, have you thought of, like, maybe trying something like that later on?
I enjoyed working with the super constrained version of this, but I think that that's not going to work for every book or every story, clearly. And I'm excited to try those other things and try to juggle more. And there'll be different ways of doing it, I'm sure. You know, the process of this book worked out, but it was invented for this book, right? Like, I've never written a novel that had succeeded. I've written a lot of failed novels. I had no idea how to do some of the things that I did here. And there's a belief that some of those things will help for the next book, but I know there'll be new processes that are needed and new things I'll have to figure out. Maybe I've at least solved this, like, keeping the book in my head problem, which is one problem. And so if that works, good. But yeah, it was a huge thing. I had no idea, especially in drafting, I didn't care. In drafting, it's like, we're just getting it on the page, and there were wild inconsistencies. And it's just like, I'll sort out later what these things need to be. But in revision, of course, you just have to. At some point, I have to know when I'm on page 300 what's happening on page 12 and how those are interleaked. Some of it is just, like, doing the work in layers. Like, you're building this. I'm going to work on, like, all the squid scenes today or something.
Yeah.
And that lets
Control F squid.
Right. Yeah, get the squid under control. Right. Yeah.
Well, Control F, I meant.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah. That, that,
no,
too.
No, yeah. You're right. Yes, Control F, yeah.
Funny how it's control that actually allows you to find control.
But no, absolutely.
It's actually a key that lives up to its
right. Yeah, yeah, well, there were, you know, and there's words that you want to control in a book, too, right? Like, this word, I have to see every usage of it, you know. You know, because they go through a place called the Black, this book, so nothing could be, like, black on accident, right? You had to go through and check some of these things. And I don't know how people wrote books on typewriters. I mean, I don't think I could write my kind of book.
You don't take notes or anything?
A little bit, but not like...
it's better for you to actually rely on the book that's in your head.
Yeah. And sometimes the notes become a constraint in a certain way, right? Or they keep you from trying the new thing. I create like hit lists. So like, these are things I know I need to work on and stuff. But and the outline is its own shifting note. Yeah, I'm definitely not a person who has like 1,000 index cards of books or post-its everywhere, or, you know, that seems great. I feel like that's a really good way to work. I see other people's offices, I'm like, that's so smart to work this way. And I just don't, for whatever reason.
Well, I can imagine someone going into Will Self's office and just ripping off all the post-it notes. He comes back in. What the hell? Right. That's so fragile, actually.
Right? Yeah.
But I want to go back to this idea. If you're keeping a 40-page chunk of the book in your head,
right,
what creative possibilities are there for the stuff that is not in your head?
Right.
How do you go ahead and work that into the stuff that's in your head? Or, I mean, do you have, like, now I'm viewing your head as a hard drive.
Right.
Like one of those old, like, 40-megabyte hard drives from back in the day.
Right.
Because we were talking about House Party earlier.
No, right. Yeah, I'm on the wrong floppy disk or something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not, I mean, it's just not as regimented as that, I think. I think that... you know, it's sort of the way you access anything else. So, you know, a little note of something you read or memory or something comes up, you know, and it's like, and you remember these things. It's very weird. I mean, we talked a little bit about, like, you know, focusing on the sentence or the language. A lot of the work gets done by, like, pointing down into this very specific thing. I'm going to work on this sentence, I'm working on this paragraph. And while you're moving around sounds and moving around, trying out different words, you know, your brain is also thinking about sort of the content in a certain way. And so even when you're focusing on the small part, I sort of believe the other stuff is still there. It's not the thing that I'm necessarily thinking about right now. And that focusing on these small issues, things that are not trying to figure out the whole plot at once, which is difficult, but trying to figure out, like, this sentence at once, which is achievable, I think, allows you to focus on an achievable task while you do the long term subconscious almost work of, like, figuring all these systems out in the book. If I had to figure all that stuff in advance, there's no way. I'm just not smart enough.
Yeah.
You know, I'm smart enough to write, like, these couple pages today and to work on this and to make this page better over a series of days and to believe that long term, give me 1,000 days and we'll get a book. But to sit down and do it in advance would be impossible. So it's okay that I can't do it all at once, because there's no version of me that could do that. I'm just, you know, I believe there are people who are maybe geniuses like that, I think. But I'm not one of them. And there's this other path to getting there.
On the other hand, and this is going to lead me to talk to you a little bit about your teaching, you do teach Gary Lutz's The Sentence is a Lonely Place.
Yeah.
And I know also that you project sentences before your class to get the students to sort of think about things, about how that is. But, I mean, you know, my question to you is, okay, look, Christine Shute can do the blood jet.
Right.
And then there'll be this marvelous difference between, you know, acutely and clearly in that sentence.
Right.
You know, is it possible for your students to get anything close to that sort of linguistic specificity? I mean, you know, at a certain point, don't you just have to rely on intuition to kind of drive the narrative forward? Or, I mean, how does this work?
I think it's both. Yeah. I think that, and of course, lots of people have different levels of how much they care about those kind of sounds, care about that kind of acoustic stuff. What I mostly want students to see is the possibility that it exists, that, you know, and that no one's ever talked to them, you know, especially I teach that lesson like a 300 level fiction workshop, you know, for most of them, it's the first workshop they've ever been in. No one has ever talked to them about sentences this way. And so just to see it for a little bit and to see, like, why is this sentence interesting? How does this work? And to talk about some of those things. And there's a lot of, like, sort of the Lycian poetic sentences I show them, because those are really easy to see it in. But there's a lot of other kinds of things that work in different ways. It's like, how is this sentence sentence a surprise? How is it interesting? And they do really well with it. And some of them move in that direction, some don't, and that's fine. But I want them to think of the text they're making as a thing itself, you know, that the story isn't about something, the story is something. And this is one of the ways we show that in fiction, is to like care about that texture of the prose. Most students have been taught that stories and poems and essays are like about something, and they never think of it as a made thing itself, because no one's ever talked to them about it in those terms. So the sentence lesson is partly just to show that madeness of the story as a thing.
To imbue them with a certain kind of responsibility to look at sentences as a unit.
Yeah.
That every particular unit, every brick is important.
Right. And there, it's funny because there's often a resistance to it because it's asking them to start a new kind of knowledge that they don't have yet. And they do. I mean, they're often very interesting sentence writers already. A lot of what I'm talking about there is really showing them ways to... ways to revise, ways to rewrite, things they can look for. And also the way that working on... I've often found the right meaning of a sentence by working on the sound of it. But get from the sound to the sense, you know, or the sound is generative. Yeah. When I'm trying to fix this sentence, you end up at the word fingerling, right? And it's like suddenly that it's generative because yeah. The sound was required to make a sentence go. And I think that's not something they're used to knowing, that you can... By working at the sentence level, you can generate a story. You don't have to have the story in advance. You can sort of find it in the language. And it's not the only way to write. There's lots of ways to write, but I want them to see that possibility. It's the thing that's worked best for me. It's got me places that I could not go intellectually. Yeah. I would never get there by thinking my way to it. And in fact, I can't really get there by feeling my way to it, but by like working head down in a sentence or a paragraph, I can sometimes get a new place and surprises me. And that's worth the effort of like moving around syllables and counting stresses and thinking about these things. And so they should at least know about it. And it's often very inspiring for the right kind of student. Some student, it just leaves them cold, and that's fine.
How many of your students resist this, though? I'm curious.
No, there's a total resistance because new knowledge is... I had a student my first semester I taught it who was like, I just think like when you're a writer, focusing on sentences like this is like... not seeing like the forest for the trees. And I'm like, sure, but you're trying to make a forest.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't about like not looking up and enjoying the bigger story. It's like, you should know the basic, I don't know. It's like wanting to play guitar, but not wanting to learn chords. I mean, you just like, you have to learn these tools and you're going to use them to whatever extent you want, but they resist and they come around. And I think it becomes less scary. It's so intimidating the first time. That's an intimidating essay. And it looks crazy to talk about, like, look at the way like this, you know, Aston's is moving through the sentence, and people are like, there's no way they did that purposely. It's like, well, I think that might not be true,
but some authors don't.
I know
some authors are like amazing. I'm
comfortable with the idea that I'm not as intuitively talented as other people, and there are other ways to like work through these things and in the end hopefully appear as though you know final books always look like they came from nowhere, right?
But I
can't do it intuitively. I can do some of it intuitively, but I can make it better because I know the rules. And for me, that the sort of work ethic and rules and sort of understanding these things makes the... Hopefully, you can at least play in the game with people who are just naturally, you know, I don't know, athletes of a certain kind, you know, in this way.
Yeah, well, certainly. But on a certain... I would argue, though, on a certain level, writers have to be blind in order to be creative. They have to do that doctoral quote about driving a car
with
one headlight out or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that's how this works, I think, in some ways. Like, what do you want to be blind to, right? So maybe you think you're thinking a lot about your inner workings of your sentences, and that lets you be blind for a while to the plot, or be blind a while to your character, and so that's the thing you discover in the fog. Maybe you're a person who never thinks about that stuff, but you're really an intricate plotter, and so your sentences are happening intuitively. Yeah, maybe there's different ways to do that, right? But I agree. Like, I would never want full knowledge of what I was working on.
Yeah.
It's good I can only see a little bit of it once, maybe, for a while. There's definitely that point where you don't want to, but I'm okay with that.
The best gods are partially blind.
Right, yeah, that's great. You know, Robert Boswell talks about, like, the half-known world, you know, which is a phrase I just really love, that, like, that's where you want to be 95% of the time you're creating, you know?
You mentioned movies as a form of inspiration and sort of getting into students and young people who are resisting.
Right.
I wanted to actually ask you about video games because I got a very sort of NetHack Zelda-like feel to the many rooms that were actually being built in this house.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
I do know that you have mentioned something about Bioshock Infinite, playing that on your Facebook page, which I regrettably is very... you're very chatty on that, so I kind of looked through...
Yeah, right.
But I wanted to ask, I mean, you know... in terms of, I mean, maybe video games are a good way to get young people to think in terms of the labyrinth and going back to the sort of, you know, mythology and all that. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, is this a one way to get young people into literature, is to sort of find common tropes in video games and other forms of narrative or not?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I grew up playing video games as a gamer from a very early age. My dad was a computer programmer, and, you know, I was playing games like a VIC-20 back in the, you know. I gave a talk. I was a visiting writer at a private high school in Ann Arbor for a year, and they asked me to give a talk to, like, the student body about writing and about how I became a writer. And I was thinking about some of the, like, early experiences with narrative in a certain way. And I was thinking about video games and, like, choose your own adventure books and playing Dungeons and Dragons, things like this, and these early experiences with malleable narratives, right?
Where you, like, had a choice.
Right, right. Where instead of just, like, the narrative being something that was, like, given to me and it's this is how it works and it's unchangeable. I can remember being, like, third grade and reading, like, a first choose your adventure book, and it blew my mind that I could have a choice of how stories went. And to, you know, be like a dungeon master playing Dungeons and Dragons and getting to, like mold a story with players at the same time. And, you know, it was so exciting. And those are roots, and the idea that, like, a story is respondent to you, or that you can make these different choices and sort of emergent gameplay and all these things. There are links to that in writing, and there are ways to do that. There's a writer, Mike McGinnis, who I don't know if you know.
I haven't read him, but I know.
Yeah, he had a great story in Best American Short Stories this year about video games. He's doing this project called Exits R, which is based on, like, the old, like, text adventure kind of games, you know, the Infocom, like, yeah, Zork and that.
Of which you actually kind of evoke in those old objects that you actually pop up. Yeah, yeah. I always get an Infocom vibe on that. Yeah,
yeah, and I loved those growing up. But he was doing these collaborative things where it was where he was, like, real time doing, like, a text adventure. You're the player and he was the game. He'd real time, like, tell these stories together in that mode where he'd give you the description blocks. You're writing commands, and it was really interesting. And I mean, one of the strongest, like, kind of art experience that I had, you know, in the last, it was about 2 years ago, but at the time it felt, I hadn't had that in a long time, where I felt we were making this thing in collaboration and we're just typing to each other, and it's real time, and it got really weird, but it was, like, really, like, we're using this tool that we both grew up with to, like, write a story of a certain kind, and it was very, very aware of the power of that, you know, that
it's sort of in the vein of Robert Coover and hypertext.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I wish hypertext had gone farther. It's a weird thing. It's a little cul-de-sac, and, like,
yeah,
his essays about hypertext and, like, the New York Times around there, where he's talking about, like, what it was going to become, are so interesting. And I wish more people. I know why they didn't. I can see why they didn't. Yeah. It's incredibly difficult and limited in a certain way. But
do you think we're at an age right now, though, in which fiction offers enough of that choice? How do writers combat the sort of entitlement complex of today's social media addicts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever thought about that in those terms as, like, something I have to do. I do think about that the text should be interactive. The text should be, it should never be dictating the terms in a certain way. Like, I shouldn't be telling you how to feel. I should be making a space for you to feel. I shouldn't be telling you what to think. I should be making a space for you to think. And I often do that for me partly by having characters who are not right and are, you know, and... you know, in this book, the narrator does things that, of course, are terrible. None of us would ever advocate as right behavior in any way. But there's this thing that happens naturally where we're trained to be on, like, the side of the protagonist, right? The protagonist is our hero, and we care about his arc and whether he gets his quest. And by you can use that against the reader in a certain way that forces them to have this emotional experience, forces them to be morally engaged. Because when the character does something that you wouldn't do, then you start to separate from them, and you start to insert yourself. It's not me telling you how to feel. It's you, like, creating this new relationship to that character. That's one way, I think, to allow a reader in. But everything has to have that. Readers have to be allowed into the books. I hate a book where there's nothing for me to do while I'm reading it, right?
Yeah.
So what's the point then, you know?
Well, there's two ways to, I suppose, do it. I mean, the one issue I'm thinking is whether ambiguity is large enough to offer that level of choice.
Yes,
great. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, which you mentioned hiking briefly earlier, we haven't even really talked about the outdoorsy quality of this particular book, and whether perhaps there's a gap right now in contemporary fiction. I feel that we need to have more woolly, wild, outdoors stuff. You know, the stuff, I mean, you know... reading Jack London as an adult and as a boy, I was so inspired by it, and just that sort of gnarliness. And do you think that maybe that might actually be another way? I guess that kind of vicarious experience or the invitation to another life besides this one that's always indoors.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I feel like I live that indoor life, and I'm, you know, got my head down on my computer or my phone or whatever, you know, and then obviously, like, the book is like this, like, you know, and I've, you know, the last book was post-apocalyptic, and, you know, Laird Hunt in an interview with Roxane Gay, a book forum, she asked him something about, like, the prevalence of, like, post-apocalyptic, like, literature, and he's like, I think we just all want the routers to be shut off, you know, like, yeah. And of course, I love all that stuff, but there is a part of me that, like, also does not, right? So yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, it's a bit, this book I wrote when I lived in a condo in Ann Arbor, you know, in the city, and then before it came out, moved to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is a much more wild space. And so it's come up a lot, like it's been assumed that like I wrote it about like this landscape I now live in, which I find really interesting. And now I'm living there and I'm writing a book about Detroit, so you know how that goes, right? But I do think it's interesting to get out of that. I'm not particularly super interested in reading subject-wise, reading things like the minutia of like day-to-day life is sort of like, and that's actually a hole that other things fill. My wife and I watched the show Girls on HBO, and we both like the show. I don't want to read that as a book though. Like, you know what I mean? Like I don't know why. I would rather not read about that in a certain way, but I really like, you know, I don't know. There's like,
I'm curious. I mean, what is your
objection?
Your objection to the quotidian? I mean, like, are you anti Nick Baker? Are you
no, not at all.
Yeah,
right?
Because he really describes the minutia of everyday life.
Right. And DeLillo is really big. Yeah, and DeLillo, you know, I mean, DeLillo. I mean, that part in Underworld he talks about like knowing the names of quotidian things is like one of my favorite passages, and I use it as an example. I'd like to tell students that you have to know the names of everything.
Are you talking more about navel gazing as opposed to finding
the
wonder
in
our
own? Right. Yeah. I think so. And there's just something very uninteresting to me about some of those things. But I'm glad other people are interested in them. We should all write about whatever whatever works. But yeah, it's just not my thing. While also saying, of course, I like Nicholson Baker Locke and like Lillo. So it's maybe more the way the subject is treated than the subject.
What are we talking about here? Can you name some kind of book that, I mean, I could probably, I'll just put myself like, so like Tao Lin's Tao Pei, Taipei, for example. I mean, I get what it's trying to do stylistically in terms of a dead style, but like, you know, I've read this type of book. I mean, I like him and I like his style. And I think this is an improvement over the last couple and it goes sort of back to the early Tao Lin. But I do feel that it's essentially dead and uninteresting and its effort to shock about the quote daily life really just kind of left me, okay, you know, I've seen this before. I saw it when Bret Easton Ellis did it. I saw it when other people do it. And yes, it's in a new voice, but that voice is not strong enough to make it like meaningful. Is that kind of what we're talking about
here? I think so. I mean, I think that broad sort of thing, I think is fair. I haven't read Taipei. The last book of Tao's I read was which Richard Yates. I hadn't read anything in a long time, and I would say like what I liked about it that I was, having not read him in a couple years, I was very impressed by how confidently he had moved into what he was doing, right? Sure. And I felt I could see the ambition of it. I could see that artistically it had gotten stronger over the years. Well, also, I think it's just not my thing in a certain way, and I'm glad other people are moved by it, but I agree. It's just not after the things I'm interested in a certain way.
Do you feel, though, that like certain literary fiction that goes too much into, I suppose, like one person's mind that becomes about their particular struggle, this is just not something that interests you? You feel that fiction needs to be a little more fluid? Or I'm just trying to get a sense of
And it's always hard to pin down, you know? I don't know, because it's not like the day-to-day life isn't interesting or it's not. I mean, of course, it's interesting partly because that's what we're really doing. Yeah. None of us are like, you know, fighting giant bears every day. You know, not none of us, but, you know, few of us.
I don't know what pay-per-view channels you have.
Right. Yes.
Secret, you know, torrents you're downloading.
But the day-to-day concerns of this book are not people's day-to-day concerns in a certain way, but hopefully the emotional concerns of it are and that sort of thing. I don't know. And some of it is just personal preference stuff. I don't know that I have a grand pronouncement about it. I've writers I like who write very sort of realist everyday sort of things that I love a lot, but it's maybe not the thing that I'm arguing more about arguing for my own aesthetic than I'm making a grand pronounce about literature, right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, so I think that it's less about this doesn't work and more of that I'm not interested in doing that as a writer, or I don't maybe even know how that's done in a certain way. Well,
this leads me to ask you, did you lay down any sort of edicts in your young life about, I will never be that kind of writer. I will never write about this because I am trying to do great art.
Right.
Then you are now in your, as you're getting older, you're starting to say, oh, well, actually, I am kind of doing that now.
Right.
Is there anything along those lines that, you've initially rejected and now have come to by accident or anything like that?
I think the only thing similar to that really is when I sort of made, I grew up as mostly like a fantasy and sci-fi kind of writer, a reader, and there was I wasn't writing when I was young, so as a reader, and then my early 20s, I started reading Dennis Johnson, Raymond Carver, Naomi Hemphill, all these people, and I really just fell in love with that, and I was just like, I was going to put all that stuff away, right? I didn't read any of it for a long time. I didn't allow it in my writing. I wrote all my early sort of short stories are like poor Dennis Johnson knockoffs, like I'm making like the imitation handbag of Dennis Johnson stories,
You got to start.
Right. And that's a good person. If you're going to imitate someone, it's a good person to do. A possible person to do, but worth trying. And then at some point I started letting that stuff back in a little bit. And it was great. And that's really when like the work started coming together, because I'm being more honest about who I am, I'm not Dennis Johnson. I don't have his experiences. I don't have his mind. I don't have his emotions. I'm not going to write Dennis Johnson stories.
But he's not Matt Bell.
Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm sure it keeps him up nights.
I have the consolation of being neither Matt Bell nor Dennis Johnson, so you can imagine how I don't.
Absolutely. Right. Yes. Terrible. Terrible. Yes. But no, so I did. I put aside that all that stuff. And at some point I let it back in. And then the story started like coming alive, started working, because it was being more honest about my interests, being more honest about, who I am, and where I'm from. It was very good. That said, I think it wasn't a bad thing not to write it for a couple of years. I think it wasn't a bad thing to go, live in the foreign country of that sort of writing. I taught a workshop a couple of years ago at like a conference, on flash fiction. We were talking about writing shorts and stuff. And, we read, Brady Udall's The Wig, which is, like a paragraph long. It's really great. And immediately a student was like, but look at all these like adverbs in it. There's like six adverbs in it. And like, you're never supposed to use adverbs. And I'm like, I mean, yes, right. Use like as few as possible or something. But like, and if you live for 5 years without the adverb, you will learn how to write sentences that don't need them, but you can use adverbs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Clearly. Yeah. So like, it's good to give up the crutch, but it's okay to like use it right, So I think like it was good. It was good for me to go away from that stuff, and then good for me to come back and let it in. I probably wouldn't be the kind of writer I am if I hadn't. Not to say better or worse, but it would be different. Yeah.
Well, on that notion of giving things up for Lent and coming back to them, Matt, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Fantastic.
Like they're setting the woods on fire. You're my gal and I'm your feller. Dress up in your frock of yeller. I'll look swell, but you look sweller. Setting the woods on fire. We're taking all the honky-tonks. Tonight we're having fun. We'll show the folks a brand new dance that never has been done.